Get it further on next week's program, or actually the week after that, because next week is our pledge drive, which we hasten to point out is a real drive. I like this metaphor. Yeah, if you don't have this drive, you won't die, but the station might. And sadly, we are out of time. This program was produced by Edward McMillan, and we're counting on you, dear listener, to call us next week and make your contribution so we can continue to do what we love to do and what hopefully you love to hear into the future. We will see you next week on Radio Parallax's annual pledge drive here at KDVS. And we're going to repeat the offer we made several years back that if you will contribute $200 to the station, I'll have lunch with you. And I won't make you pick up the tab. Anyway, we'll see you next week.
And this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. If you saw our Facebook post, then you would know that we are going to a special broadcast over at Enloe Medical Center. They're going to be discussing Obamacare and many, many, many other things and how it relates to the standard insurance payer. That's coming up in just a couple minutes, so stay tuned to FM 90.1. More to come.
This is Ken Logan and the Doctor's Inn. Today, you will be experiencing with us a live broadcast from Enloe Medical Center conference building across the street from Enloe. And this conference or forum and panel discussion today is on the Affordable Care Act. The title is Report Card on the Affordable Care Act. There will be three panelists. One, a practicing physician from Paradise, Dr. Thorpe. There will be a representative from the California Hospital Association. And there will be Dr. Bill Skeen, the president of the California chapter of Physicians for National Health Program, PNHP. They will be the three panelists who will each give about a 15-minute presentation about the consequences or how it's going with the Affordable Care Act. This forum and panel discussion will be moderated by the CEO at Enloe, Mike Wiltermude. And we're about ready to start. There will be question and answers after the panel discussion. And I hope you'll tune in for that, too. This will be great. By the way, this is a free-to-the-public forum, panel discussion. It's open to all of you. Any of you who want to sit in live yourself at this forum panel discussion, it's at the Enloe Conference Building across the street, across Enloe, Esplanade from Enloe Main Campus.
And the Doctor's Inn is made possible by KZFR members and by Friends of the Arts, a state local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts has been creating economic opportunity through the arts and culture by producing community festivals and events, including Artoberfest, Chico Palio, the True North Tour, the Silent Film Festival, the NorCal Jazz Festival, the Salmon Festival, and more. To learn more about Friends of the Arts, visit friendsoftheartsupstate.org and also by Advantage Insurance Services. Local independent insurance broker Dave Dalton can provide you with all of your insurance needs. Advantage Insurance is proud to support KZFR and can be reached by calling 342-0540. For a quote or more information, visit them online at AdvantageInsuranceChico.com.
The forum and panel discussion is just about to get underway. They're kind of putting themselves together here. The importance of a discussion included with question and answer from the audience on the Affordable Care Act has to do with this has been present for a number of months now in action, the Affordable Care Act. And really, what we're going to talk about today is how is it working, the pros and cons. Where are some of the good things that are happening with this, and then some of the downfalls of the Affordable Care Act? Issues from the three panelists will include, again, a representative from the California Hospital Association. It's going to be important to hear how the Affordable Care Act has been impacting the hospitals in the state of California relative to pay and availability to the patient's care. Another member of the panel is Dr. Richard Thorpe. He's a internal medicine doctor in Paradise, who is a recent president of the California Medical Association, which is a remarkable position for one of our local physicians who have had. He has much experience in not only private practice and how the Affordable Care Act has been impacting his practice and the care of his patients, but also he's very knowledgeable, as you can imagine, in the politics, if you will, relative to issues such as the Affordable Care Act because of his recent title as the president of the California Medical Association. And then the third panelist is Dr. Bill Skeen. He is a past emergency room physician who now has the position as president of the California branch of something called the California of the organization, national organization, the California branch of the Physicians for National Health Program. And he is going to be a wealth of knowledge, and I can't wait for this panel discussion to begin, and that will be very shortly. Stay tuned.
Okay, good evening. I think we're going to go ahead and start. I'm David Potter. I'm a member of the medical staff at NLO, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the program this evening about the Affordable Care Act, a report card. In case you're in the wrong room, this is not the talk on, hi, I'm Joe's prostate. So anyway, that will be the subject for this evening. I'm also to remind you that this evening's program is being broadcast live on KZFR, so that's what these guys are doing over here. And if you have occasion to be speaking, for whatever reason, this would go for the speakers in particular, there are some people on the radio who won't be seeing what you're pointing at with your slides and so forth. So I think I was to remind you of that. Anyway, welcome to all of you, and thanks for coming. It's my pleasure to introduce Mike Wildermuth, who will be the moderator for this evening's event. Mike is the CEO of NLO Hospital. It says here that he's been in hospital leadership for 30 years, which is a pretty long time for kind of a young-looking guy. He's also been CEO of NLO since July of 2009, and for those of you who don't remember, NLO went through a period of time where being CEO was like a little bit like being the coach of the Sacramento Kings, where they changed rather regularly. So he's actually one of our longest-serving and best-regarded of administrators. So anyway, hope you'll join me in giving Mike a round of applause, and we thank him for being the moderator this evening.
Well, thank you, Dr. Potter. That was a nice introduction. I can't really speak to my looks, but I do need reading glasses, so I'm old enough for that. Thank you very much for coming tonight. I want to thank Dr. Potter for helping to spearhead this event, and also Dr. Ken Logan for getting us in his show, The Doctor Is In, on KZFR. The purpose of tonight's report card on the Affordable Care Act is to share information, have a discussion about the hits and misses of the program. It's an informational session, not necessarily a political debate, to better understand how the Affordable Care Act has affected hospitals and physicians in our community. Now, the format of the program is we're going to have three presenters from our illustrious panel here, and I'll introduce them in a minute. Each presenter will have 20 minutes, and we'll be taking questions at the end. All opinions are valued. We would encourage you, if you have a question, we've got some cards going around and staff to pick those up. And hopefully, we'll be able to address all your questions in the time that we have allotted. So let me introduce our panelists. Our first one here, and I hope you can tell which one this is, it's Amber Kemp, is Vice President of Healthcare Coverage for the California Hospital Association. She provides advocacy and support for government-funded programs and other healthcare coverage policy issues affecting California hospitals and health systems. She has an extensive background in Medi-Cal and most recently worked in the director's office at the California Department of Healthcare Services, where she managed the implementation of the Medi-Cal waiver for the Delivery System Reform Incentive Payments Program for designated and non-designated public hospitals. And if you understand what I just said, You need to get a job in public policy. Welcome, Amber. Our second presenter in the middle of the three there is Dr. Richard Thorpe. Dr. Richard Thorpe has practiced general internal medicine in Paradise, California. Some of you may be his patients. For 38 years, which beats my 30 years in healthcare administration, he's on the medical staff of Feather River Hospital and is president, CEO of Paradise Medical Group, a physician-owned primary care group. His leadership experience includes immediate past president of the California Medical Association, past president of Butte Glen Medical Society, and a member of the American College of Physicians, as well as a member to the American Medical Association House of Delegates. Thank you, Dr. Thorpe, for joining us. Dr. Bill Skeen has the record for the longest trip, coming from Santa Barbara. Dr. Bill Skeen serves as the Executive Director of Physicians for a National Health Program here in California. He has 20 years of experience in public health advocacy and has practiced emergency medicine for 10 years. He was formerly Director of Public Policy for the statewide advocacy organization Florida AIDS Action, and served as the Director of Grassroots Programs for AIDS Project Los Angeles, or APLA. Dr. Skeen and the PHNP brought the concept of hosting this event to Enloe. Thank you very much, Dr. Skeen. Each of our presenters has taken a lot of time out of their busy schedules to be with us. We appreciate your attention and attendance. Thank you very much for your presentations. Amber Kemp will be our first presenter. And if the other members of the panel want to take a better seat, please feel free. Whoops.
Thank you to Mike and your leadership and your staff and for being so welcoming and for hosting this event today. So I'm going to start by providing an overview, a national perspective of ACA implementation, and then I'll dive down and talk more about California's experience, and then discuss some of the pressures facing hospitals and the healthcare industry, and then where the industry will be heading in the coming years. So to start, let's take a look at the Medicaid and CHIP enrollment under the Affordable Care Act. So as we can see here, 11.2 million individuals have been enrolled under the Medicaid program since the enactment of the Affordable Care Act. Now, as you know, many states states had the option to expand their Medicaid programs to individuals up to 138% of the federal poverty level. California was one of the states that very quickly embraced the coverage expansion provisions of the Affordable Care Act. But as you know, many states decided not to expand their Medicaid programs, and largely that was based on political reasons. So as we see here, the line on top, that shows the expansion in the states that have expanded their Medicaid programs. And as you can imagine, this bottom line here, the states that did not expand their programs, they haven't had as much of an increase in those states. So when we look at the uninsurance rate, it is at the lowest, at 11.9% since the Gallup poll began tracking it in 2008. And what we see is it reached its peak at 18% right before the provisions went in place for the Affordable Care Act for individuals to have coverage. So after January 1st, 2014, we see the uninsurance rate decrease, and then we see it spike a little before the end of the first open enrollment period. And so we know that there were other factors here. We know that the economy was improving and the employment rate was improving. However, when we look at the uninsurance rate and along the same timeline as the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, many folks do think that the ACA has in fact contributed to the decrease in the uninsurance rate. This here shows the status of states' Medicaid expansion decisions. And as I mentioned, states had the option to expand their Medicaid programs. What's unfortunate here is that in those states that decided not to expand their Medicaid programs, they're leaving roughly 4 million individuals in a coverage gap, meaning that they make too much to qualify for Medicaid in their states, but they don't make enough they make too much to qualify for the other ACA expansion provisions, so for the exchange subsidies. So they're in this coverage gap, and that means that 4 million individuals nationally could otherwise have coverage if they just perhaps lived a state over that did expand their Medicaid program. And this here shows the state health insurance marketplaces. So states had the option to either establish their own state-based exchange, which California did. California was the first state in the nation to establish its exchange under the Affordable Care Act. States could also partner with the federal government for a federal-state partnership exchange. And then many states just threw up their hands and said the feds could go ahead and do that. So they have a federally facilitated exchange in those states. And what we know is that under the Affordable Care Act, 11.7 million consumers have been enrolled through marketplaces. So those marketplaces are where individuals who earn up to 400% of the federal poverty level, they're eligible for those advanced premium tax credits. If they're up to 250% of the federal poverty level, they're also eligible for cost sharing reductions to make the cost of their care even more affordable. And then individuals over 400% of the federal poverty level are eligible to purchase coverage in marketplaces if they don't have employer-based coverage or that's affordable. So many folks who were self-employed now have the option to purchase coverage through the marketplaces. So one of the first tangible tests of the Affordable Care Act is really how affordable is it making coverage for individuals. So the Kaiser Family Foundation looked at the premium rate increases over the past year. And what they found was that nationwide, the premium rate increases were fairly moderate. We know that in California, on a statewide aggregate basis, the premium rate increases for the marketplace only rose by about 4.2%, which is, in fact, lower than it has been in the past. So this is leading folks to believe that, yes, health coverage is becoming a little bit more affordable under the Affordable Care Act. And as you may know, the public opinion remains stable. So nearly 5 years after the ACA has been implemented, folks are still in the same range with 46% finding the Affordable Care Act unfavorable and 41% finding it favorable. And as you may know, this largely rests along party lines, which should be no surprise there. Now, when you ask folks, average consumers, about the Affordable Care Act and how much they know, Kaiser Family Foundation asked this question here about the individual mandate penalty. So were folks, did they know that if they didn't have coverage, there would be a penalty? And did they know what that penalty was? And we see here that 72% of the respondents, they either didn't know or they just elected not to respond. 3% of consumers had the correct answer for 2015. However, 6%, they stated an answer, they stated the 2014 penalty, which means that they likely didn't know that the penalty increases in years 2015 and 2016. And then we have the 19% there other. So this is really interesting because we're going to see how this plays out this first year, this first tax season under the Affordable Care Act. For the first time, individuals' health care experience is now tied with their tax experience. So that will have implications for individuals who maybe they received too many subsidies because Covered California didn't have updated data, and maybe they owe the IRS money. So this will be interesting to see what the consumer's experience of care is and their experience after year one of the ACA. Now, partisans are still divided on the future of the law, as you know. This here shows that roughly 24% want Congress to expand what the law does. 21% are fine with moving forward the way the law was implemented. 12% would like the law to be scaled back, and 31% would like the law repealed in its entirety. So this is not surprising that we'll still continue to hear debates on how effective the ACA has been for consumers. Now, with that national perspective, I'll move more to California perspective. As you all may know, our state Medicaid program was very successful. California really led the nation in terms of ACA implementation by really embracing the coverage expansion provisions. So in terms of our Medicaid program, there are now over 12 million Californians enrolled in our state's Medicaid program. Roughly 1 in 3 Californians is now enrolled in our program. Our state's Medicaid program is the largest Medicaid program in the nation. It is twice as large as the second largest Medicaid program, which is New York. So this has huge implications, not only on providers in terms of reimbursement, but it has had huge implications from the consumer perspective. Consumers are reporting access to care issues. They're not able to seek primary care. They can't get specialty care appointments. So this is very concerning that more folks do in fact have coverage, but they don't actually have the access that they need to get services. And what hospitals have seen is that the demand for services has in fact surged. So this here shows that there have been an additional 200,000 acute care Medi-Cal patients seen in hospitals and 3.6 million increase in hospital Medi-Cal outpatient visits. And what the data shows is that those newly insured in Medi-Cal, they are in fact using more services than they were using when they were previously uninsured. When we look at the data for Covered California, we see that there was no measurable difference from third-party coverage to Covered California coverage, which leads us to believe that many of the folks who are, in fact, enrolling in Covered California either were previously self-employed or had employer-sponsored coverage. So, and as you all know, coverage does not equal access. As I mentioned, the access issues are driving folks who are insured to emergency rooms because they don't have the access to primary care and specialty care. And this is very concerning. Another factor in this is the reduced payments to primary care physicians that was not extended past the 2 years that it was permitted for under the ACA. So we have some serious access issues. And while it's wonderful that there are many more folks that are covered, we just need to make sure that these folks can actually access services on a go-forward basis. With regards to the Covered California marketplace, California had one of the most successful marketplace launches in the nation. with over 1.4 million individuals enrolled in the first year alone. Now, we do know some data about this first group of enrollees. About 80% of them went ahead and re-enrolled for 2015. 9 out of 10 of them stayed with the health plans that they had selected in 2014, and Covered California reports that they did some shopping around. They went online, they compared to see what was the best option for them, and 9 out of 10 consumers stayed with their plan. Now, through the second open enrollment period, we see here that roughly 500,000 individuals enrolled through the second open enrollment period. California and the rest of the nation actually extended the enrollment period. They created a special enrollment period through the end of April for consumers who, when they go to do their taxes, found out that they had a penalty and they didn't realize that they were going to have the penalty. So Cover California created a special enrollment period for those individuals to go ahead and then seek coverage through California without having to pay a penalty. And Cover California reported today that in this special enrollment period thus far, about 75,000 individuals have enrolled. 22,000 of those individuals reported that they did not know that they would have had a penalty. So those folks were able to then seek coverage through the exchange. Now, the financial impact to hospitals under the Affordable Care Act has been immense. Hospitals over the first 10 years of the ACA are bracing for $22 billion in Medicare cuts, and the cuts keep coming. And so the concern is, well, we have more and more folks entering the system, and we already are starting to see the access issues. We're not seeing an investment in resources into the system. We're actually seeing funds, you know, being taken away from the system. So it's going to require hospitals and other providers to really look at providing care in a different way. And I'll talk about that in just a moment. So there's a lot of uncertainty that's next, and there's a lot of potential actions that we're still waiting on to really know how successful the ACA is and how it impacts consumers. So we're still waiting on the possible ACA target amendments that were included in the president's budget proposal. We're still waiting on the Supreme Court's ruling for King v. Burwell. The validity of those subsidies that are provided in the federally facilitated marketplaces. And while California has a state-based marketplace, so that in theory wouldn't apply to us, it absolutely would have an impact in California, because many of the health plans that operate in California also operate on a national level. So to the extent that they would be affected because the individuals in other states wouldn't have access to those subsidies, we would definitely feel that in California as well. We're still waiting to see the effect of the employer mandate as well as the individual mandate penalties, and we'll know more about that as we kind of come out of this tax season. And the impact of narrow networks. Now, historically, the market tends to correct itself a little after there have been narrow networks. They tend to widen a little bit. But we still need to see the outcome and to see if that really happens. Covered California has taken the role as an active purchaser, and they are very upfront about the fact that they have narrow networks. They're limiting the networks so they can keep the cost of care more affordable for their consumers. Also, the high out-of-pocket consumer costs. Covered California reports that an alarming amount of individuals are selecting the silver plans and the bronze plans, and those are the plans with the higher cost sharing for the individuals, higher out-of-pocket maximums, and so forth. So consumers really need to be educated about the coverage options that they are selecting and to know where they'll get the best bang for their buck. We do know that many consumers who are, in fact, eligible for those cost-sharing reductions because they are under 250% of the FPL, many of them are selecting the bronze plans. So they're not actually selecting more affordable coverage. And so there's definitely an opportunity there to provide more education to consumers and more health literacy. The convergence of Medicaid in the marketplace. So Medicaid, now with 1 in 3 Californians on the Medicaid program, Medicaid is the largest purchaser of healthcare services in the state. And as we know, many individuals will churn between Medicaid and through the exchange. They will go back and forth as their income fluctuates. And so Medicaid and the exchange, along with CalPERS, will be aligning a lot of their value-based payment programs and quality improvement initiatives. And that will definitely have an impact on our healthcare delivery system in California. And then I also listed here in 2017, the states have the option to open their marketplaces to large employers. And so that is another area we're waiting to see how many employers are going to put their employees in the exchange, because, you know, it might be a better ROI for them. And we fully anticipate that many employers will, in fact, do that. And then many more individuals would be covered through our marketplace. So with that California perspective, I wanted to just touch on a few more pressures on the healthcare system. So here we see the national health expenditures, and we know that the U.S. spends about $2.9 trillion, or roughly $9,200 per person, on healthcare. And our country's per spending on healthcare as a percentage of the GDP is roughly 17.4%. And that's not sustainable, even though we know that this has moderated over the past 5 years. We know that whenever the government is in crisis, they start to take more and cut more from Medicaid and Medicare. So this is very concerning for providers. Now, many folks are starting to look at health expenditures as a percentage of GDP compared to social services investments. And you see the United States there. We have some of the highest healthcare expenditures as a percentage of our GDP. Look at the other states. They make far more investments in social services, in old age pensions, in housing, in ensuring that their society is taken care of to prevent them from getting ill. And so the question here, and what many researchers are starting to question, is why the U.S. is spending more on healthcare, but we don't actually have improved health outcomes compared to some of our nation colleagues. So this is of interest to researchers lately. When we look at the hospital share of the healthcare dollar, we see that over the past 30 years, it has in fact declined. In 1980, it was 43% of the healthcare dollar, and now it has declined to roughly 33%. And if we look at the other categories, they're all roughly the same, with the exception of one category there, that red category, prescription drugs. Now, prescription drugs have probably helped to mitigate folks being in hospitals. They've kept people out of hospitals. They've helped, you know, individuals manage chronic conditions and so forth. But the question is, you know, how do we expect that to look in another 30 years? We definitely think that the share of the hospital dollar will in fact decrease. But what other areas do you think will increase and decrease over the next 30 years? So that's very interesting to think about there. When we look at California's per capita cost, California provides care that is typically cheaper than the rest of the nation. And so we really need to give providers kudos for that, for keeping people out of hospitals, for providing care. And that's largely because of our integrated healthcare system. systems and providing coordinated care. And a lot of folks always ask, well, does Kaiser have something to do with this? And they do. And so I can't stress, but even if you remove Kaiser from the system, California would still be performing very well. But I can't stress enough the value of the integrated healthcare model. And we have some of the lowest utilization rates in the nation. So we are good at keeping folks out of hospitals. Now, this here is the case mix index, and this shows how sick patients are. And as we can see here, patients over the past 10 years, they are getting sicker, which is very concerning, because the sicker a patient is, the more expensive they are to treat, the more chronic conditions they typically have, and the more services they need. And this is really troubling when we look at California's population growth, and especially when we look at the aging population. So if you look at our population growth, we're on par with the rest of the nation. But when we look where the population growth is, we see that in some of the rural areas are where we're going to see more concentrated population growth. And this is troubling when we look at the next slide, which is the aging population. So here we see that the population over, you know, between 55 to 65, you know, will grow by 3%, but the largest rate of growth will be for the population over 65%. And this is concerning because as people get older, they get sicker and they are more expensive to treat, have more chronic conditions. And our research shows that this concentration is occurring in rural areas, which is very concerning, as you all know, because there are provider shortages, and there tend to be even greater provider shortages in rural areas. This here shows the incidence of chronic disease, and we know that for every 1% change in the incidence of chronic disease, there is a corresponding increase by 6% in utilization. So as folks are getting older and they have more chronic disease, they will need to access more services. And that's troubling because we look at our population growth and we plot it with licensed beds in the state, and we see that we don't have as many beds, and hospitals have been closing over the years, and so that's also very concerning as well. And this here, we took health status and we plotted individuals in or areas where individuals have more than two chronic conditions, and we plotted that with where they lived and the primary care physician capacity. And it was really concerning because we found that in areas where folks needed care the most, they didn't actually have the primary care physician capacity. So that's very concerning, especially that we know in California, roughly 30% of our physicians are over the age of 60, so nearing retirement. And then when you think about the influx of the Medicaid population and how California has some of the lowest reimbursement rates for Medicaid, you know, are those physicians really gonna, you know, be able to stick around and continue serving this population? We don't know. So that's a big question for everyone. So what are hospitals doing to prepare? We recognize that population health management, this is today. This is the way the healthcare industry is moving. There's this recognition that we have to manage the health of our population. We can't just see individuals on a one-by-one basis. We need to understand what it needs to be a whole person care delivery system. And especially when you look at how expensive chronic diseases are, they account for 75% of our nation's healthcare spending. That's very troubling. So we have to manage the health of populations. We also know that this is where the payment models are going. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services recently announced their goal that by 2018, they would like to have 50% of their payment arrangements be more value-based. And then after they made that announcement, a group of private purchasers said, well, by 2020, their goal would be that 75% of their payment arrangements would be value-based arrangements. So folks are definitely more interested in managing the health of populations, improving the healthcare quality, and achieving the triple aim as envisioned under the Affordable Care Act. And so what we will see is we will see organizations take the role of a population health manager to help manage the health of populations. It's not always going to be a hospital, and it's not always going to be a health plan. And in fact, there are many folks vying for this role. You see the retail industry vying for this role, Walmart, CVS pharmacies. A lot of folks want to be that healthcare population health manager. And so what will it take to achieve that vision of population health management and improve quality, improved healthcare, and lower costs? It's going to take leadership. It's going to take buy-in by providers and other entities to understand that we need to work together to manage the health of our population. It's going to take stakeholder participation. It's folks reaching across silos, partnering, collaborating. We're seeing that with the recently announced Vivity model, where seven hospital systems came together and forged an alliance with a health plan saying, we want to work together to manage the health of our population because we see that this is tomorrow, and this is the only way that we can achieve the triple aim. And it's going to take folks working together on common goals and principles, and we are going to have to work within the framework of the reforms that are before us. I think many folks had hoped that the private market would have the innovation and would be able to make this change. And I think we're going to see a lot of this take place in the public arena as well as Medicaid and the exchange converge. Expanded coverage is great because now that folks are covered, we can actually focus on improving their health and well-being. And then lastly, it's going to take funding and other investments, so it will be an expensive endeavor. And so how we're preparing hospitals is we've developed a population health management program for all persons within the hospital, all levels of leadership, because this new model, it's a really new way of doing business, and there's business imperatives and clinical imperatives and, you know, including persons and their families in discussions and improving their health. A lot of technology infrastructure is needed, and this is new technology, new use of data analytics to improve the health of populations. So this is how we're working with our members to ensure that they are prepared to provide the best quality care and to improve the health of their communities and to lower healthcare costs. So I'll stop there, and then happy to take questions during the panel session, but feel free to reach out with any questions afterwards as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Amber. We'd like to invite Dr. Richard Thorpe up next.
Thank you, Mike. And thanks, Amber. That was a really excellent overview of the Affordable Care Act and what the implications have been for everyone. I do think there are a number of points that Amber made tonight that are really critical. There have been some very good things that the Affordable Care Act has done. It has actually increased access in a broad variety of ways. Many millions of people that wouldn't have had access to care before now have care. It has some problems, and I think there are some questions that everyone has. Many people have been adversely affected by some of the implications of the Affordable Care Act, whether it's a higher premium cost for you in the individual marketplace, or whether it's facing those higher copays and higher deductibles, so that when you do go to your doctor's office or you do go to the hospital, you find out that, oh, by the way, you have to pay for some things. For instance, if you're going to have eye surgery, or you're going to have hip surgery, or you're going to have some other major procedure, you have to pay up front in order to get that done. And many times that will cost you your entire deductible, like $4,500. This is kind of what it feels like to be in practice today. I've shown this slide before, and so some of my colleagues will forgive me for showing it again, but I think it does make the point that most people who went into medicine to practice went there because they wanted to take care of patients. They wanted to actually do something worthwhile. They didn't want to run a business necessarily. They didn't want to try and figure out how to fill out the paperwork, how to do proper referrals, how to make sure that you got paid for what you did, that you got an authorization for doing the test that you thought was necessary. I want to just take you back about 150 years. 150 years ago, medicine was pretty basic. Many of the things that we could do 150 years ago were very basic, meaning we had no antibiotics, we had no vaccinations, we could do some surgeries, but most of the time when you went to surgery, it was a life-threatening event, whether it was cutting off your finger or taking off your leg, and most of the time you couldn't do abdominal surgery because there was no general anesthesia. What you had was you had the doctor there trying to do the best he could, trying to make the right diagnosis, and the truth is, much of the time all you could do was just, you know, pray or whatever your mode of, you know, meditation was, and hope the patient made it through the night. When I left my residency, I have to apologize, I don't know where that biography came up and said that I had been in practice for 38 years. I'm old, but I'm not quite that old. I've been in Paradise for 34 years, so that's essentially the same, I guess. But I left my residency program in 1981 as chief medical resident. I thought I was a pretty smart guy. I came here to this community because I wanted to serve in a smaller community and wanted to be active and do all the things I was trained to do, which, if, you know, thanks God, I was able to do. But in the last 34 years, the practice of medicine, and you talk to any doctor in the room, the practice of medicine has been transformed, amazingly transformed. One of the reasons the costs of care was so low in some of Amber's graphs were because there wasn't much care to give. I mean, you were in the hospital. You might have been in the hospital 2 weeks for a pregnancy and for a birth, but they didn't do much for you except just walk you around and feed you. Today, the reason we have people in the hospital and the reason they're so sick is because we are now able to take care of a huge variety of illnesses that have just escalated over the last 35 years because we're doing a much better job and because the science of medicine has really dramatically increased logarithmically. So I want to talk about a few other things here in terms of the future, what the future might look like. Amber did this sort of at the end. I'm going to do it more at the beginning. There are a number of things that we've been working on for years. You know, we've had the fight against cancer. We've had the fight against diabetes. We're still going to need to be doing those things. And sometimes what we've been doing more of than I would like to admit is trying to protect the status quo. Many doctors, as time has gone on, their revenue has decreased, and so they're trying to figure out ways, well, how can I do a better job of that? There has been an attempt to try and improve this fragmentation of care issue, and it is true that independent practice has taken a hit. Very, very few doctors today want to go into independent practice. That is, not be many more doctors want to be part of a group where you have a set hours and you get a salary and those kind of things, rather than going into practice like I did, where you work essentially 12 hours a day, 15 days a week, and got one weekend off. I think what we're seeing now is increasingly the independent doctor is losing some control of the quality and patient safety, and there's no question that data control is really becoming an issue. As we are, even though we're moving more and more to the computer model, the data isn't interchangeable. We're clearly not at the place yet where we can exchange data freely across the whole system, like in Butte County. If I want to try and talk to someone like Dr. Potter or Dr. Sprague, I have to call them personally or fax them to exchange information. There's no way to do that electronically, at least in a seamless way. So many doctors are working more and enjoying it less. So I sat back and thought to myself, well, what would I like it to be like? If I could have healthcare the way I wanted it, and if I was God or King, how would it be? And I think it would be something like this, that the patient's care comes first, not the finances of healthcare, although the finances of healthcare are very important, not the computer, which is becoming a very difficult challenge for many doctors, and not necessarily physician reimbursement. But it would be a time when the science of medicine and the financing of medicine actually come together and are harmonious. Because we're making incredible strides in the science of medicine, but what we're challenged with is how do we pay for it and how do we encourage young, bright, talented doctors and scientists to go into the biosciences to make the future even brighter than it is today. I think the key is that the science of medicine needs to be delivered at the point of care. I think there are tools that are developing there. And what I mean by that is today we order something or we see a problem at the bedside or in the office in the exam room, and you try to fix the problem or try and address the problem, but there are insurers, there are people in the way trying to, you know, sometimes it's managers of various sorts who are trying to get in the way and say, well, you can't order that scan or you can't order this test because it's not appropriate for this patient. However, they're not there in the room. They don't know the patient. They don't have the clinical information. So at some point, we need to be able to deliver all of those algorithms at the point of service so that the person who's actually taking care of the patient can get the work done that needs to be done. And I think at that point, then, the physician's decision for the patient needs to take precedence. We were talking a little bit about, you know, population management and patient-centeredness and all these things. The question is, well, who makes these decisions? Who shapes the future of medicine? Is it philosophers of medicine? Are people in basic science? Is it clinical science or physician clinicians? Is it the government? Is it health plans, hospitals, big pharma, economists, or is it consumers? Well, the truth is it's kind of all of these people. And so some of the things that we're talking about in terms of integrated care and population management and population health and chronic care management, all of those things are some group of people's ideas about how can we actually provide better care and decrease the cost in them at the same time, and yet still preserve adequate payments to hospitals, adequate patients' payments to clinician providers like doctors and non-physician practitioners, so that they can actually afford to do the work. So I was thinking about this and looking at some information over the last couple of days, eight ways that the Affordable Care Act is affecting us, and I think it's not just affecting us in these ways, it's affecting patients as well. As Amber already pointed out, this was the largest insurance expansion since 1965 when Medicare and Medicaid were initiated, and it's a historic change. So number one, there's a lot more covered service. There's increased preventive health services in the Affordable Care Act, and there's no out-of-pocket cost. That's a great thing. People get their blood pressure checked. People get mammograms. People get physical exams. These are very good things to have happen, and it's good for the society to have a healthier population. The benefit package, some people can say, I would say for myself, I probably don't need maternity benefits. But on the other hand, you know, that is part of the enhanced benefit package. And that's one of the reasons why these exchange packages are a little more expensive. But a third thing is even more important, is that for the first time in the history of the United States, a person who is on the individual market has guaranteed issue. That means they can go to an insurance agent and they can be sure that they can actually get insurance. That's a huge thing for someone who's not working, because prior to this, the only way you could be sure that you had insurance was if you had an employer who provided insurance. And if you lost your job, very quickly you lost your insurance. That's a very unstabilizing thing, and it's really not good for business, I don't believe, to have that kind of an uncertainty. The other thing is there's no lifetime or annual limits on coverage. So in the past, one of the common practices for insurers was if it looked like you were starting to incur very high costs, you were using the system a lot and using a lot of expensive services, they would send you a notice that of rescission, meaning they were going to rescind your insurance policy. Sometimes that was because they were just being insurance company people and wanting to make more money. Sometimes it's because they thought you had actually lied to them on your application form 20 years ago or 10 years ago, whatever that case may be. But that cannot happen now under the new law, and that's a benefit for everyone, I believe. So there's more patients with coverage, more people with health insurance looking for a doctor. That can't be a bad thing for doctors or for patients, except that there's a mismatch. As Amber alluded to earlier, we're dealing with a physician shortage, and we're dealing with a provider shortage, not just physicians, but non-physician practitioners as well, physician assistants and nurse practitioners. The Medicaid expansion also has some implications access. There has been this large increase in the number of people who are enrolled in Medi-Cal, especially in California. But if you are a Medi-Cal patient and you're asking for a primary care doctor in Butte County, it's going to be a challenge because there are very few doctors who are accepting Medi-Cal for a number of reasons, and we can go into that. The question for the exchange, a little different issue, did they offer adequate rates to ensure that their people who they were enrolling in these plans would actually have coverage? And in fact, there's some evidence to show that they were intentionally not enrolling enough doctors and intentionally underpaying to try and keep their costs down. Now, that's great for the insurance company, but if you're the patient, that's not great for you. Sometimes they've used these all products clauses, meaning that if you have a Blue Shield, if you're a doctor or a provider and you have a Blue Shield contract for, I shouldn't use Blue Shield, a health plan contract for a HMO product and a PPO product, and the health plan says, well, if you want to keep those contracts, you have to also take our exchange product. I'll just tell you that the exchange in Butte County, I don't think this is proprietary particularly, but in my practice in primary care, I'm a general internist. I see a lot of geriatric people. I do a lot of Medicare and some private insurance. When Covered California came to us and asked us, would you like to join the network for these plans? We said, well, sure. You know, what's the conditions and everything? Well, currently with several of our major plans, we get paid less than Medicare to see those patients. So Medicare pays a certain amount of money. We get paid 90 to 95% of what Medicare pays for those plans, which is a surprise to some people. When the exchange came in, they said, well, actually, we were thinking about offering you 70% of your current rates. Well, 70% of 94% is 63%. It's not a sustainable rate because you just on the business model, you have to have a certain amount of money to pay overhead, to pay salaries, you know, to pay all the things that you need to do to run a practice. And frankly, at that point, my group just said no. It was interesting. I happened to be the president of the California Medical Association at that time, and I had an interview with an Eastern paper, well-known in the business world, that interviewed me about this whole exchange rate, why there was a problem with the physician enrollment in the exchange. And they had the idea that doctors in California were actually boycotting the exchange. And I said, well, you know, that's actually not true. What's happening is doctors are making a business decision about whether or not this is a sustainable market for them. And in fact, when that quote came out in that paper, I about 2 days later, I got a call from the head of provider relations for Blue Shield for one of those health plans, and actually for another one as well, that said, you know, well, actually, we should come talk to you because I think we can work something out. And we now are participating in that plan. So the other thing that happened is there's higher out-of-pocket payments. If you are on the California Exchange and you have an income of $45,000, the average silver plan will create a deductible of $2,500. That means you have to pay that money out of your own pocket before you can actually get any insurance services that are paid for by the health plan. The copay per office visit is about $45 to $65, and that's paid up front every time you go see a clinician in that system. Both patients and doctors have had to adjust to this whole process because people who were using a health insurance before were used to a very minimal copay, $15 to $20 copays per office visit, and a very low deductible, often $400 or $300, something like that, not these sizable dollars. So there's something good about that, is that it gives you as a consumer, it makes you feel what it costs to actually get health care. Now, you can argue that feeling is too painful, and I can understand that, but this is a reflection of the costs of actually providing the care. It has been a benefit to primary care, and I can't say that I've always felt that there was a benefit to be primary care doctor, but that in the Affordable Care Act there has been. In Medicare, through this year in 2015, Medicare paid 10% additional to primary care doctors. Medi-Cal for 2013 and 2014 increased their rates to Medicare rates. Now, that may not sound like much to you, but currently Medi-Cal rates in California are running approximately 50% of Medicare, and Medicare rates are Medicare rates. So that was a huge increase for primary care, but it wasn't for every doctor. It was only for primary care doctors. There was some advantage to being a patient-centered medical home in the Affordable Care Act. It did increase preventive medicine. It was a benefit to primary care because of these preventive medicine, wellness, and chronic care management codes that were built into the Affordable Care Act that gave additional incentives to provide that care. Number five, as Amber alluded to earlier, it has resulted in consolidation of physician practices. Consolidation either in hospitals, large medical groups, or in IPAs. We're starting to see that a little bit in Butte County. It's not a huge process yet, but there are doctors who are consolidating around Enloe Hospital, Oroville Hospital, and Feather River Hospital. And as in the 1990s, hospitals are finding ways to acquire physician practices. Now, if you remember back in the 1990s, in the HMO days, there was a big trend in hospital acquisition, but in about 8 years, it went bust. Most of those doctors that were acquired went the separate way from the hospital. The problem is that today the economy is so tenuous, I would say, that it may be more difficult for doctors to leave those organizations today than it was back in those days. So this is good and bad for customers.